The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Welcome, everybody. We are going to go slightly out of order today. A note on Senate Bill 659. We had that scheduled for Tuesday, and it wasn't ready. And we have it scheduled for today, and it's not ready. But this bill will... do I have to open a public hearing to explain what's going on? So this bill has to do with when a couple separates and they have a child with a significant disability and they live in different states, and the parent to whom the child visits that they're not regularly with, ensuring that they have access to the home and community-based services that they need when the child comes from out of state. And we're working with the department to get that language right in a way that doesn't get us in trouble with CMS, which is always good quality in a bill to not get sued by anybody. So we will reschedule that when the language comes back. We'll wait for the work session until we have enough members. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 475.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Sorry.
Senate Bill 475 does not have a subsequent referral. It expands juvenile detention education program provision of educational services to include juveniles in youth care centers with detention facilities.
And I just have Molly Rogers, but does Laura want to come up too? Just Molly? All right, Molly. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gessler. My name is Molly Rogers, and I am with the Wasco County Department of Youth Services. And I appreciate the opportunity to provide public testimony today on behalf of Senate Bill 475. I'm here representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, as well as NORCOR, which is a regional juvenile detention facility located in the Dalles. Senate Bill 475 is addressing a population. Currently in juvenile detention facilities, there's the opportunity for two different populations to be housed in the same facility. One is around detention and very traditional forms of detention. Could be both pre- and post-adjudication. And the second are youth care centers, which are actually treatment programs located within detention facilities. The profile of the youth is very similar to youth in detention. However, the length of stay for youth and students in youth care centers is often from 90 to 120 days. And so what Senate Bill 475 does is it allows the students or the youth that are in the youth care centers to have access to education for the same length of time as youth currently lodged in detention. The current detention is for 220 days of education, and for the youth care center youth, it's only 180 days. The importance of this and the story I'll tell is a young person who is, hi Dan, that went into a youth care center. Often these kids are the ones that are most disconnected, if not dropped out of education programs. And the young man that went in often every day watched either TV or video games. And in our youth care center, we have a high-performing teacher that's supplied by our school district. And about 3 months into the time that he was at our youth care center, he called me on the phone and said that he had passed his science test. And the standardized testing, I'm not sure if it's OAKS or whatever the titles are, for him to actually be able to graduate. And his story was that he wants to be a writer. And my astonishment was I did not know that he had ever read a book. And he said, "No, Molly, really, since I've been in here, the teacher's taught me that reading can be fun. And that I can do well and I can pass my test." Kids in the youth care centers have the time to be able to actually do some credit recovery as well as gather some information and start to love learning. Currently, how the statute allows or how the funding occurs is it comes through two different funding streams. And again, the education services for our detention is through an RFP process every 2 years. And the YCC kids, youth, are placed through the school district. A couple of years ago, when the RFP went out, our school district did not make the cut. It actually became an ESD that wasn't from our local region. And our education for our detention youth all of a sudden went from a high-performing teacher to packets and what was going to be online. That's the other piece that this bill can fix, is that it streamlines and creates at least equity in what the education for the students are. That ESD actually chose not to continue with our detention program because we had such a strong program and our detention facility wasn't ready to give up on having a teacher in the classroom and just going to online packets. I appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to us today and would answer any questions that you might have, but I really encourage and strongly appreciate your support for Senate Bill 475.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, ma'am. Senator Gelzer and members of the committee, my name's Dan Carr, and I am the Detention and Facility Manager for Douglas County Juvenile Detention in Douglas County, Oregon, and I run one of the current YCC programs here in the state of Oregon. It's my honor to testify before you today on a subject that, well, it may not be affect vast portions of the juvenile justice system, but for those of us who operate youth care center programs, this is a really welcomed piece of legislation. In Douglas County, we currently have one teacher providing instruction in our 32-bed detention facility, which is staffed at 24 beds. The Roseburg School District has turned the juvenile education program over to Douglas ESD, or Educational Service District, to provide education to detention youth who are currently averaging at about a little over 10 youth per day. The Roseburg School District also contracted with Douglas ESD to provide education to youth in our youth care center program. We have an average daily population of about 8 youth in YCC right now, and they are counted on the school district's rolls. They are receiving the same education in the same classroom provided by the same teacher employed by ASD that the JDEP youth are. JDEP youth receive about 220 days of instruction, whereas YCC youth receive about 180. While the YCC youth, their stays in our facility are generally much longer than detention youth. I'm not privy to the terms and conditions of the contract between the Douglas County School District and ESD providing education to the youth in YCC, but if YCC youth became part of the JDEP, it would make that contract unnecessary. The legislation would move YCC youth under the JDEP rolls where it makes sense for them to be. I asked our teacher, I said, what would be the impact of us moving the YCC youth underneath the JDEP program? And she gave me a great big long list of things that I won't go into here, but generally the upshot of it was is that it would eliminate duplication and complication of trying to run two different programs in the same space during the same period of time. So that would, in essence, bring all youth to the same level for the same period of time, which makes it much easier to facilitate. And when things are much easier to facilitate, it then becomes much easier and you achieve a higher level of education for those youth in that simplicity. The legislation, I guess it would be probably one of the least controversial bills that you'll be considering this session, okay, due to the minimal impact.
We don't have any controversial bills this session. Everything is a consensus. Right, Senator Olson?
Depends on what side you're sitting on.
But I think, really, at this point, this legislation just makes a whole lot of common sense. And from an operational standpoint for us in the YCC facilities, it would allow us to better serve the youth in detention and eliminate needless duplication by our educational staff. And by that, would improve our educational system, which is where our focus needs to be with these youth, as was explained by my associate.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Well, I thank you, and thank you for bringing this to our attention. These are pretty vulnerable youth, and I think it's easy to really forget the little fixes that are needed to make things work better for them. And I'm really grateful to Laura for the work that she's done in the Department of Ed over the last couple of years, really putting forward the needs of these youth and all of you as well. And I hope we can continue talking about them. This committee is going to go on a field trip on... Are we going?
17th.
Yeah, on St. Patrick's Day on March 17th, and we'll be visiting Oak Creek and the Children's Farm Home all on the same day. So getting a chance to
see. I do have a question.
Great. Senator Olson and then Senator Montes Anderson.
Ladies first, always.
All right, Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you. I was wondering, do we have any sense of the cost? Will this take a lot of money out of general fund?
We have the department here.
Senator Gessler and Senator Moni Anderson, I would have to defer that because I'm not part of LFO or the department.
But Jan is.
I know this is a ways and means question, but...
Chair Gelser, members of the
committee. Will you pull the... Thank you.
For the record, Jan McComb from the Department of Education. In our analysis, we think this affects about 8 students, and so it's about $81,000 a year.
It's worth it.
My question was, you had mentioned 220 days and 180 days. Would those students at the 180, would they be able to get to 220 then?
Yes, they would be elevated to the 220 level. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's a good value.
Yes.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we will work on
Madam Chair, Senator Dimbrough. I do have a question. Thanks. I actually brought this up with Laura, and I'm putting on my workforce committee hat now. Whether any of the youth in these programs are. I know that there's some counseling and, a lot of work with them to get them back into their educational mainstream. Are there also any activities that they do that might be considered sort of getting them ready for the world of work, when they are
Absolutely.
Working to get their lives back on track?
Absolutely, Senator. We do all sorts of things from a vocational standpoint as well as from an educational standpoint. All of the youth that participate in the YCC program are taken through and given their food handlers cards, for example. So they go online, they take the test, we pay for the card, and they walk away from the program with a food handler's card, which has actually, as they have progressed to other different programs or have reentered back into society, has allowed them to almost immediately go out and be available for a job. We do various other things as far as we do different sites and tours of contractor sites, things like that. And we're looking currently into a kind of a vocational work by day type of a program for those youth that already have achieved their educational level of a GED, can then participate in a vocational type program where they actually go out and participate and learn a work skill.
Okay, thank you. And just if I could follow up, the new Federal Workforce Act has a real focus now on students that are out of school, that where there are efforts to get them back into school and to use employment as one of the draws to get them back into school. And, it could be that down the road there might be some opportunities for programs related to that for these kids.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah. Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll work on getting this scheduled as soon as we can get the fiscal back. Does that meet with your approval? Great. Thank you very much. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 475. At your desks are these yellow books. These are from the Family Impact Seminar that was held last week, and the organizers kindly left copies of each of these books for us. It fits in with our charge to be looking at early childhood and the role of what happens in early childhood with addressing poverty.
So there'll be a test, right?
There will be a test.
I will administer it.
Multiple choice,
All right. Let's pop up to Senator Cruz. Both of these other public hearings are yours. Can we do the information hearing first?
Yes.
All right. So I'm going to open up the information. Oh, well, let's do the work session. Let's, now that everybody's here. So we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 503, which is ready to go.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 503 was previously heard on February the 19th and then briefly opened and closed for a carryover on the 24th. We are, we've notified the President Courtney's office with the recommendation that it be referred subsequently to Joint Ways and Means, given the fiscal impact statement that is issued. It's posted on OLIS and available in hard copy at the dais for everyone. This is the measure that expands the temporary assistance for domestic violence survivors program to include victims and potential victims of sexual assault. It increases the amount available from $1,200 to $2,000 per recipient. And it requires the Department of Human Services to include that additional information data in a report to the legislature that they already prepare every odd-numbered year.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 503 with a do-pass recommendation that the bill be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 503 with a do-pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there a discussion? I would just add, I hope that this meets with favor down in Ways and Means. Is anyone here on that sub?
Oh, it's great.
Oh. Senator Montesinger, are you on the sub, the Ways and Means sub? Oh, we should start assigning visitors so that our bills get their dollars attached. But this is, I was really impressed with the testimony last week. I think these are really important resources to help people move on from really difficult situations. And I'm really grateful to Sybil and all of the organizations that brought this forward and the great work that they all do in the community. So is there any objection to the motion to send the bill on? Seeing none, the motion passes, and the bill is sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 503 and open an information system, an information meeting on the addiction system. And I invite the addiction system. Do we have the list? I do. So Tom Hartnett and Karen Wheeler, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I assume, have you decided who's going first?
I think I will set it off, and then I'll try to hurry up and give people time.
And so, we have a third person.
And this is Luz, say your last name.
Oropeza.
A prevention specialist from Hood River.
Great.
If that's okay.
Of course.
Okay, and then I also have Ray. And I forget his last name, to talk about recovery services,
okay.
If there's time.
That is absolutely fine, too.
So for the record...
Do you want to bring a chair and come on up? Getting the chair to come to the front is a test. It's like an initiation thing we do here.
Maria can help. So good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting us. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler. And I'm the Behavioral Health Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I'm really pleased to be able to kick this off and provide you with some information about the addiction services system in Oregon. To start off, I would like to talk about who's affected by addiction. And am I supposed to be operating this? You may be in trouble. Arrows. These arrows. Okay. So I'll talk about who's affected, the system and the budget history, the system components in terms of what's available in Oregon, and where we're going. So first off, to talk about who's affected, about 300,000 or so Oregonians are impacted by alcohol and drug abuse who have a diagnosis of abuse or dependence. And that number we get from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is conducted every year by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So we use that to kind of gauge how many people in Oregon have a problem. And as of late, for the past, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, we've really been looking at opiates in terms of people struggling with prescription drug abuse and dependence. I've been around long enough to remember that the conversation used to be really focused on methamphetamine 10, 15 years ago, and now we're pretty focused on opiates. And unfortunately, some of our numbers don't look too great. We've had annual deaths of overdose of 300 plus per year, which exceeds the number of people who die each year from traffic accidents. So that is something we're very focused on. And just to talk briefly about where addiction comes from, there have been a lot of things in the media around addiction. Sometimes we'll see articles with information. HBO did a series a number of years ago about addiction and actually encouraged people to have meetings in their homes and invite their neighbors and talk about addiction. And we know that addiction has a biological component and a genetic component. There's gene expression when it comes to addiction, but there's also very much an environmental component when it comes to addiction. I'm very excited about the sea change conversation that's happening right now around trauma and stress and toxic stress as it relates to developing not just addiction but health problems, and the great economic impact and physical and societal impact of these problems as it relates to childhood trauma. So addiction is defined as a chronic relapsing brain disease, and it's characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite harmful consequences. So that is no surprise to anyone. So this diagram comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it's basically an overview. It's part of the overview summary of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And that study, many of you have probably heard of it. There's a large group of people who had Kaiser Permanente health insurance. I think the study included 17,000 people who had Kaiser Permanente, and it's a longitudinal study about the health conditions of this population, which is a fairly, you know, normal middle-income population who had health insurance. And they asked these folks if they'd had adverse childhood experiences. Basically, it's a 10-question test. I've personally taken it myself, as many of you might have taken it also. And the higher your score, you get 1 point for each question that you answer positively. The higher your score, the more propensity you have in terms of health risks, which includes drug use, drug addiction, alcohol, as well as other health and physical conditions. So this pyramid basically demonstrates that adverse childhood experiences lead to social emotional impairment, adoption of risk behaviors, and disease and early death. So the worst outcome obviously being an early death, which people are not able to achieve their full potential if they're using drugs or smoking or overeating and developing serious chronic health issues. So I'm excited to have some other people in the room talk about prevention, because there's actually an inoculation or an immunization, if you will, that we can actually apply to a population and help to prevent addiction. Addiction is preventable. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a snapshot of, I talked about the ACE study, the 10 questions. People who had higher ACE scores, you'll see on the bar to the very right in each of these categories. These are people with who scored five on the ACE test, five or more. So you'll see an exponential increase in these folks having a drug problem or being addicted or even injecting drugs. And again, these are people who had Kaiser Permanente insurance. These are not people who were street addicts or anything of the sort. So now to talk about the cost burdens associated with addiction. I won't read this whole thing. It's widely documented that addiction costs society a lot of money. Addiction costs Oregon a lot of money, too. But in terms of the national statistics, one that stands out for me, Dr. Tom McClellan, the very last bullet, when he was testifying about the Affordable Care Act, he talked about a $100 billion annual cost to America for untreated substance use. In Oregon, the last study that I'm aware of, there may have been one since its time, I haven't seen it, but Eco Northwest performed a study to determine how much untreated substance use costs Oregon, and it was almost $6 billion. And the largest cost being lost earnings. So we have healthcare, law enforcement, criminal justice, the things we all think about. But again, that lost potential is a huge cost to Oregon. So now to talk about what's available, where we've been, and what's happening in the eviction system. We do have prevention, and Luz is going to talk about prevention more. She's an expert in prevention. But we do have prevention that's primarily funded in Oregon by a federal block grant called the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. It's also funded by beer and wine taxes. And that includes state beer and wine taxes that come from the Addictions and Mental Health Division to counties, but it also includes some beer and wine taxes that local counties get and put towards these services. So there's a match contribution there. And we also have contracts with all of the federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon to provide prevention. We have outpatient treatment available in each region of the state. So each county gets some base funding for outpatient treatment. And we also have outpatient treatment funded by CCOs, or coordinated care organizations. We have 15 medication-assisted treatment programs throughout the state, and these programs provide methadone maintenance and detox therapies. And then we have about 80 doctors throughout the state of Oregon who are what we call data waivered, or Drug Abuse Treatment Act waivered doctors, who prescribe buprenorphine, which is another medication used to treat opiate addiction. At any given time, we have about 5,000 people in medication-assisted treatment in Oregon. This map provides you with just a snapshot in time right now, and this is how many residential and detox programs we have in Oregon. And the icons are different types of programs. So we have some programs that specialize in serving culturally specific populations. We have one Hispanic-based program, and we have a NARA, the Native American Rehabilitation Association program in Portland. And then we have some women-specific programs. We have 84 beds that are basically focused on women's programs so that women can take their children and their babies to treatment with them and keep them right there with them while they're going through treatment. We also have a men's program called the Dads Program in Medford, where dads do the same thing and they take their kids with them to treatment. And then we have some gender-specific residential programs as well. One of the things I'd like to briefly talk about is the fact that on July 1st of 2013, we transferred the Medicaid-funded portion of the residential treatment program over to the CCOs. So there was a budget transfer from AMH to the medical assistance programs for that. We set fee-for-service rate structures for both detox and residential. We did a lot of training with the provider system about how to bill and counter-billing. So there was a whole host of activities around that that related to communication, stakeholder engagement. It was a big lift. So that was done in 2013. I feel like I'm going really fast.
I'm trying to go fast, but not too fast.
You're doing well.
So we also have recovery support services in this state, not as many as I would like to see us have, but we have some recovery housing or Oxford houses throughout Oregon. I think we have about 180 throughout the state, and we hold a contract with Oxford Houses International to develop those homes in Oregon. We also have some rental assistance programs for people who are in recovery who need support, families who need support in that way. We also have peer-to-peer recovery supports, and Ray actually provides those services, and he can talk in more detail about what that means. And then we have peer wellness and wraparound, childcare, transportation, things like that, that are paid for by AMH funds.
A quick question. When you talk about the support that's available in the recovery housing, how available? What's the difference between the available stock and the need?
Ray could probably talk more about his area, but I would say there's a definite need for housing, for recovery-related housing, especially in some areas. I know in Deschutes County, Multnomah County, the affordable housing itself just isn't available for a lot of folks, and especially people who have addiction histories, who may have criminal history on something on their record, they have a really hard time getting into housing.
Okay.
There's typically a waiting list for recovery housing in Lake County anyway, so.
Okay. So.
Oh, and can you state your name for
Ray Brown.
Ray
Brown?
Ray Brown, yeah.
Ray Brown.
Thank you.
I'll remember your name next time.
Okay. I just have this record that we have to keep. So
I kind of wanted to talk a little about the history from the early 2000s because some really key things happened in early 2000s. During 2002 and 2003, about $25 million was lost out of the addiction treatment system. And that was due to the recession. We lost OHP standard. And then we had some additional general fund reductions in 2003. And what happened as a result of that is about 1,000, we did a survey for all of our providers, both on the mental health side and addictions, and 1,000 addiction counselors were laid off. They lost their jobs. And most of them got into a new profession. They left the profession or they moved away to another state to get jobs elsewhere. So that is infrastructure that was lost during those years that we're just now trying to gain back. And then when we lost OHP standard, as you all know, we lost the ability for some adults who didn't have children to get access to services, healthcare in general, in addition to addiction treatment. This slide gives you a picture of the budget trends as it relates to the treatment side. So the green parts of the bar basically show the addictions and mental health budget in terms of our funding for treatment. And again, those are beer and wine taxes, substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant funds, some general funds, and some court fines, fees, and assessments that come to us from DUII or driving under the influence of intoxicants offenders. So that pretty much comprises the budget for AMH. And this shows you the trend from 2001 through projected 2015-17. And you'll see the green bar going down, down, down a little bit, which the explanation for that is that some funds have been transferred over to the medical assistance programs so that the residential and the detox services can be matched with Medicaid and get that federal match to pay for those services.
Question? Now that we have CCOs, and I heard a figure close to 40% have drug and alcohol problems. Maybe we don't have those numbers yet, but in CCOs, they have a global budget, and they are to address this population. And so I'm wondering if there's much communication now with this kind of data and what we're hoping to achieve with the coordinated care organizations.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Senator Mona Sanderson, absolutely. We have more communication and coordination with medical assistance programs, the Medicaid office, than I've ever seen us have in the 18 years that I've worked for state government.
Since
it is almost
CCO.
Like we're working for the same, I mean, we are working for the same department, we're OHA, and we work very closely together with both the county structure and the CCOs. I mean, it's a daily conversation. How can we get this information out to both of these groups, making sure that our plans are woven together, making sure people understand that we fund certain services, the CCOs fund certain services. How does that all link together? It is a daily conversation.
So when we start working on teasing out monies, rather, I mean, I think that's an issue that maybe we haven't dealt with that goes with mental health too. So we want to make sure that we have a really coordinated effort in I just need
absolutely.
To get that on the record.
Yeah? Absolutely. You're absolutely right. So I'm very I feel very pleased and hopeful about the blue part of the bar and that more people are getting access to addiction treatment. So, and I will talk about that a little more later too. The next slide is just a picture of a report that we did with the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs in 2008. And I actually remember the meeting in Roseburg. Senator Cruz was there. We did a gap analysis to determine what was needed in the addiction system from prevention through recovery in 2008. At that time, it was determined that we needed about $137 million over the course of 6 years to really fill the gap. And that included treatment, which was by and large the largest portion there. We didn't contemplate at that time in 2008 that we would have the Affordable Care Act and there would be more people having access to Medicaid-funded treatment because of the expansion. We didn't contemplate that. So if we were to go back and do this again, the amount needed for treatment would be much less. It would be much reduced because most people have a benefit, as you said. So, talking about where we're headed. So, where we were, we had managed care fee-for-service before the CCOs. We had payments based on encounters. The mental health benefit was carved out, and we had mental health organizations. And now, in 2012, we stood up the coordinated care organizations. And we have payments based on accountable outcomes. We have incentive payments to CCOs based on their outcomes. We had residential and detox services that were carved out and paid for separately by Addictions and Mental Health. And now we have the full continuum of addiction services, including residential and detox, that are paid by CCOs for people that have a Medicaid benefit. We had underinsured and uninsured Oregonians, and as you know, in 2014, we had the expansion of Medicaid. And then the other thing that I'll note is the rates. Many of the providers are struggling because the rates have been flat for so long, the residential treatment especially. And so we did a rate study that was requested by the legislature in 2013. And it was determined that, in fact, the rates are flat and they do not pay what it costs to provide the service. So AMH still pays the room and board, and those rates did increase slightly this year or this biennium. But still, the portion of the rate that includes the service or the clinical portion has not drastically increased according to what the rate study said it needs to be. So I just wanted to mention that. This diagram basically, to your point, Senator Mona Sanderson, talks about how the funding of the system works together. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying everything's perfect everywhere around the state, but we have Medicaid funding through the health plan and CCOs. We have state and federal funding through AMH and community mental health programs. Who sometimes are counties, sometimes it's a nonprofit entity that's the Community Mental Health Program. We do have in statute the requirement for an agreement, a memorandum of understanding between the CCO and the CMHP. And then we have providers that have contracts with CCOs and who also sometimes have contracts with the county or the Community Mental Health Program. We also have some direct contracts ourselves with providers, AMH does. And we provide services for people who need a safety net. So the AMH-funded services are for underinsured people who might have private insurance, but it's just not enough to cover the cost of treatment, the kind of treatment they need, or the amount of treatment they need. We have uninsured people still, people who are undocumented and do not have insurance, or maybe their insurance lapsed. They didn't do something, so their insurance lapsed, and they need some kind of service in the interim time. And then one thing that I'm starting to pay much more attention to, every 9 seconds, somebody in this country turns 65. And so
every 9 seconds,
somebody turns 65 years old.
That person, that poor guy.
I know, and I'm getting closer and closer to that. So one thing that's important for us to remember is Medicare does not have a robust behavioral health benefit. So many people that are accessing funds services that are funded by AMH are over the age of 65. And I'm contemplating that for substance use services as well. This has a big impact on the mental health side of our house, but people, addiction is a chronic relapsing disease. People need a lifespan of service. So we need to figure out how to reach people that are over the age of 65 for addiction services as well. And this picture just shows it a little bit differently from a person's perspective. The green circle is basically things that are included in the Oregon Health Plan benefit, but sometimes people don't have that and they need AMH to pay for that, detox, medication-assisted outpatient treatment, residential treatment. And then the things in the blue circle are things that are paid by AMH, the room and board for the residential, child care, transportation, peer services, and things like that. And prevention really should be wrapped around everybody. Everybody should get prevention, some kind of prevention, whether it's community prevention that you'll hear Louise talk about, or clinical prevention, which happens in a clinical setting with things like screening, brief intervention and referral to treatment, or ESPERT, you may have heard of that. So now just to give you a little snapshot of what it's looking like in terms of people accessing addiction treatment who have the Medicaid benefit. So we see that for the quarter immediately preceding the expansion, so 2013, quarter four, and then if you compare that to 2014, quarter one, and that's right after the expansion of the Medicaid, you see it jump way up, and then it continues to jump up for that next quarter. So we're hoping to see that continue to grow and for more people to be accessing addiction treatment.
Do you have a sense of, more people accessing the services, did the intensity and quality and frequency of the service stay the same, or did you have more people and with a diluted pot have less access than fewer people had prior?
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, that is possible to see in a drill down of the data. I do not anticipate that there was a watering down of the service, because this really is an expansion in the unduplicated count, number of people who accessed any kind of either outpatient, mm-hmm. detox, or residential service. So it was within our system with the same standards and the same quality of care that we have for anybody else who accessed treatment before the expansion.
I guess the question would be, so somebody comes in and they need housing, but you go from 11,000 people to 22,000 people, and housing isn't just about the payment. There's a capacity for that. Is there the capacity to provide the same level of service as fast for 22,825 people as there was for the 11,533?
So Chair Gelser, I'll clarify. This only includes the treatment, so not the housing.
Okay.
But I will say, and probably not to throw the ball to you, Tim, but Mr. Hartnett will probably talk about workforce. There is a workforce issue. There is a point where if we have too many people demanding the service and more people needing treatment, and as I said, those 1,000 counselors were laid off, we're trying to build the workforce back up, there will be a point where it's a tipping point and we need more people to actually work in the field.
Okay. Thank you.
So hopefully some of you have seen our strategic plan. I believe you may have received a copy of it. We did the same kind of regional groups, regional meetings with a lot of stakeholders over the past couple of years, and we developed a strategic plan for AMH. And the parts of that plan that relate to addiction services, basically we have the opportunity to improve recovery services. We are focused, obviously, on people getting access to a benefit, whether it's a private benefit or Medicaid, and we want to focus on keeping people in recovery who've accessed treatment. We also want to focus on prevention, so things that are on either side of that spectrum of treatment, because that's more within our budget now. We also want to...
Question. I'm still back on the other slide. In your unduplicated count... How many are get on OHP or are within a CCO? Do we have that information yet?
Chair Gelser, Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I apologize. I should have made it clear that that slide, let me go back there one second, this is only CCO and Medicaid people.
Okay. And that's a global budget. And so
yes.
The contracts, it gets convoluted on, you know, the contracts are with CCOs. So we don't want these CCOs. We want good treatment. And each CCO really has to make sure that they're meeting the needs of those with drug and alcohol problems.
Absolutely.
All right.
You're absolutely right. Okay. So this is my wrap-up slide. I won't rate it. I'm just going to say that I'm very, very hopeful. We have a lot of opportunities. We have opportunities to focus on prevention. We have opportunities to focus on the workforce because that's very much needed. And then opportunities to really look at recovery and keeping people connected to something so they can maintain recovery and not backslide. So I'm going to end it there. And
I have
any questions?
Maybe someone's going to address this, but I'm very interested in the types of treatment programs. We've had this issue before. Are they really evidence-based? What is the recidivism rate of these people that enter in? Are the programs effective? That's a real issue for me, and I don't know how much you're doing with that type of analysis of the treatment programs that we have and figuring out which ones are better than others, et cetera.
So, Chair Gelser and Senator Mona Sanderson, I'll mention one thing before I just hand it off to the next person. We did a follow-up. We did an outcome study. We followed people for 12 months. We did a six-month set of interviews with, I forget the number of people, but I can get that to you. And we had some of our largest treatment providers engaged in this study. It was done by MPC Research. 80 to 90% of these folks in 1 year were clean and sober. And I will get you the study. We've developed fact sheets on the study. I was actually pretty blown away by the positive outcomes of the treatment that's happened in the state of Oregon.
It'd be nice to have 1 year, but then it'd be nice if we can have 5 year.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. And you've got your two guests with you, too. Shall we do that? And then
sure.
We'll have you do clean up. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Chair Gelser and members of the committee. This is an honor for me to be here. This is the first time I have been in one of these committees, so as you can see, I'm a little nervous, but it is an honor, so thank you very much. I have brought you...
So there's a trick. It goes much easier if you say your name for the record first.
Okay. My name is, it's a long name, Luz Maria Oropeza Castro.
Thank you.
And I work in the Hood River County Prevention Department. I coordinate the Odell Hispanic Drug Prevention and Health Promotion Coalition. I was born in Mexico and was brought to the United States as an infant. And my parents are both migrant farm workers. I myself worked in the orchards while attending public school at the same time. I was a teen mom, and I, with the help of teachers, my community, and the health department, I was able to graduate on time in 2009 with my class of Hood River Valley High School. I am passionate about the field of prevention and community health because of my family and the community I live in. This experience has helped shape my desire in promoting healthy behaviors in everyone in my community, in my peers, in my family. Just last year, I was certified, or I was trained and certified to become an Incredible Years trainer or facilitator, an evidence-based best practice program, and I will be facilitating my own series pretty soon. And I want to help parents raise healthy and active children. I now have, my child is 6 years old, as he's very active. And if you want, I have pictures of him on my phone. Hood River is a rural community, or county, should I, of 22,500 people. Our school district has 4,000 students. About half are Hispanics, and it has the second highest per capita rate of Hispanic and Latinos. The prevention department has worked collaboratively with agencies and different partners under the guidance of the Oregon's Addiction and Mental Health Office, as well as the Oregon Health Division and the Commission on Children and Families Services System. It has used the Strategic Prevention Framework to address problems associated with drug abuse, and it has it to reduce drug abuse, suicide, bullying, child abuse, neglect, unwanted teenage pregnancies, and juvenile crime. We also try to focus on increasing assets such as graduation rates, early childhood health. And funding for this office comes from mainly two grants. They are the one of them is a prevention award from the AMH of about $62,000, and the second one is from the Tobacco Prevention Office, which is an amount of $58,000. Because Hood River is a minimum grant county, it has had the need to supplement its resources with other grants from federal, state, and other foundation funders. As I had mentioned, we use the Strategic Prevention Framework, which focuses on the use of data analysis, local conditions, training, strategic planning, implementation, and evaluation. I would like to emphasize that every dollar spent on prevention, there is a $9 worth of in savings. Not only is it in savings in money, but prevention saves lives. And I would like to highlight some of our successes in Hood River County. It is the second healthiest county in the state of Oregon, according to Robert Wood Johnson. It has, for the last 4 years, it has had the lowest child abuse and neglect rate and the third highest graduation rate in the state among comparable districts. 72% of the Hispanic students in Hood River Valley High School have an on-time 4-year graduation rate compared to Oregon's 65%. And our criminal referrals have dropped from 206 in 2008 to 126 in 2013. Alcohol use has also dropped for both 8th grade and 11th grade. Among all Hood River County 8th graders, 30-day use has dropped from 25% to 15% in the last 5 years. And in 11th grade, it has dropped from 52% to 39%. Tobacco use has been shown to decrease from 1998 to 2008. However, within the last 5 years or so, it has shown, we have seen an increase in use. And this has been a, so, yeah?
Do you
Does that include the vaping? You know, vaping is all the rage, and I'm wondering, is that included in your in the study or the survey or whatever?
Chair Gelser, Senator Moniz Anderson, and members of the committee, we do ask questions about, in regards to how they use this, and we have seen there to be an increase in tobacco use as well as marijuana use, and it is very common now for kids to use e-cigarettes. So they can use them for both. Some don't have tobacco, but nicotine, they have nicotine. And they can also use hash oil on these e-cigarettes. So now those are seen more frequently, which is why we have seen a rise now in tobacco and marijuana. Did that answer? Okay, thank you. We are proud to say that our county has adopted tobacco smoke-free policies, and these have included electronic smoking devices. These policies have been implemented on all county properties, campuses, library, and low-income apartment complexes. Among our youth, we have built capacity over the last 12 years, and this has been done through the health media clubs at the both middle schools and high school. My younger sister is in that club. She loves it. Their goal is to enhance drug prevention policies and elevate the use of those youth who do not use alcohol or drugs, and this is done through they are using the Above the Influence media campaign as well as the More of Us campaign. With the legalization of marijuana, we are concerned about youth exposure and access to marijuana, coupled with their decreased perception of harm. So their perception of harm, as it goes down, the risk of use goes up. The prevention department has coordinated training across various agency partners to develop a network of prevention coalitions, and you can refer back to the page that has the graph on use. It is listed there who we have partnered with, and this is all done to reduce the sale and service of alcohol and tobacco to underage youth, as well as to decrease the sale of alcohol to intoxicated customers, as well as DUIs. We use a strategic prevention framework, but we also receive training from Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America, and the Strategic Prevention Framework Project. Over the last 15 years, we have certified 11 prevention specialists in the county, and they are seated on in a variety of agencies, from DHS to nonprofits, hospitals to school district, Head Start to even parole and probation. Our training is in use of local data. We use the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey, student wellness surveys, as well as information from the State Epidemiological Outcomes Work Group. All of this has assisted us in assessing our community, planning, implementing, and evaluating our prevention programs. These successes would not have been accomplished on a stable funding of $61,200 each year provided through AMH block grant. That is why we have tried to access different resources from other grants and funders. A strong, well-funded AMH office at the state level will help achieve similar results in other counties. Primary prevention is not well understood by providers in health fields. Many believe that it is simply health education. In its initial phase, health transformation has focused on healthcare rather than the creation of healthy environments, and that is all understood. We are working to strengthen the voice of primary prevention at the community advisory council table and assist physicians and dentists, counselors, and healthcare practitioners of the value of primary prevention. And I don't think I mentioned this at the beginning, but I am a consumer member of our community advisory council for our CCO Pacific Source, and a community health worker as well. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to be here in front of all of you, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And you, I would never guess it was your first time here. You're a pro.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, my name's Ray Brown, and I can talk about peer support, but what I really came here to talk about was that I am a man in long-term recovery from chemical dependency, and that treatment, prevention, and recovery support services work. In middle school, I experimented with drugs and alcohol. In high school, I became dependent. I got married at a young age, and I moved to another state, trying to get away from the chemicals here in Oregon, and ended up coming back after 5 years and met a bunch of meth cooks and became an IV meth user. Within a couple of years, our kids were taken into foster care. My first wife went to prison. I was incarcerated. And I began my treatment experience. Residential, outpatient, five treatment placements. The last treatment placement I was in, I was in there for 4 months, and I had the opportunity to...
Can you push the microphone back? It's really sensitive, and it's
okay.
Getting a little feedback.
Sorry, I was just trying to speak up.
No, you're doing great. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. So after treatment, fifth treatment, residential, I was given the opportunity to be a single dad raising three kids, and my kids were in foster care. I'd been on probation ever since I was 15 years old, and... A person that really cared in my life was my probation officer. He never gave up on me. He kept putting me into treatment. He kept locking me up. He kept working with me and trying to help me. And there was years where I just didn't want any help. I was suicidal a lot of times in my addiction. I wanted to give up. I wanted to jump out in front of the next truck several times. My family wanted nothing to do with me. I couldn't even see my kids for a while because I was too ashamed, and when I would go see them, I would have a syringe in my sock because I had to shoot up. I didn't know how to deal with those feelings. And after getting out of treatment and becoming a single dad, it was really hard. A lot of the meetings back then that I went to, people smoked in them, and it was hard taking three young kids, and I was riding the bus. I had a job in another town, and so I would transfer buses, and I did the single dad thing for about a year, and ended up getting divorced in recovery and met my current wife. We've been married 20 years, and she had three kids, and so we blended our family of six kids. In high school, I got kicked out of high school, out of the 4J district, actually, and one of my goals for my kids was for them to graduate. So five out of our six kids graduated high school or alternative school. So in recovery, I've been able to get my record expunged. I've had the same job for over 20 years.
Where do you work?
At the Relief Nursery in Eugene. In the Accessing Success Drug and Alcohol Recovery Support Program. We parented those six kids, and we now have 9 grandchildren. I have 5 daughters and a son. Our youngest daughter didn't graduate, so 5 out of the 6 did, and she became an addict a couple years ago. And she had 2 children also, and they're now 2 and 4 years old, and the state took those kids also, and my wife and I became a foster parent. And so for the last 3 years, we've had our grandson and now our granddaughter, and we actually got approved to be foster parents through child welfare, where our kids were taken from at one point. So the end of January this year, the adoption was final, and we now adopted these 2 kids because we didn't want them to go to stranger care and never see them again. So I went to kindergarten orientation last week. I'm 52 years old, and I'm looking forward to the challenge that it brings. And parenting is so much different today than it was even early in recovery. But recovery works. That's just the thing I want to say is I know that my understanding about treatment settings is that they all have about the same outcomes. It took me 5 tries of going to treatment before something kind of hit me in the head, and I was really done. I was really done living in bars, being homeless, living on the streets, ripping and running, going to jail. I mean, that was my lifestyle, and it just almost seems not even real today to think about it. One of Karen's assistants asked me to speak a couple weeks ago, and I said, absolutely. I'm glad to speak about recovery. I see recovery come in the lights of people every day. I see kids return home to parents on a regular basis. I see people get their 1-year coins, their 2-year coins, their 5-year coins, their 20-year coins, and giving back to other people and helping other people learn how to stay sober. In fact, when I was hired at the nursery after 2 years being clean, I said, what do I do? And they said, go show other dads how you did it. And that's what peer-to-peer recovery support services is. I got to pick them up, give them rides, take them to treatment, help them get to meetings, talk to them about support groups and help. It was like a great job, and with my criminal background, it was hard to get before I got it expunged. It took 3 years to get my record expunged. I became a drug and alcohol counselor, level 1, and then a level 2 a few years ago. And recently, over the last year, I became program director at the Relief Nursery. And so it's just amazing to see kind of like where I was at over 22 years ago to where I'm at today. It's almost like unbelievable to me as well. So anyways, thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Are there questions? Senator Cruz.
Just a comment. Congratulations. The 16th of next month, I will have 29 years.
Awesome.
So there is life on the other side.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being willing to come and share your story.
You're welcome.
It's a testament to how important these services are.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. You're on.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, my name is Tim Hartnett. I'm the executive director of CODA, an alcohol and drug treatment agency serving people in the metro Portland area. I'm also the recent past president of the State Providers Association. I appreciate the chance to talk with you today. I'm going to try and I tried to imagine what would be useful for you all to hear about today, and I thought I'd talk about something optimistic, something that I think we need to be cautious about, and something we should keep our eyes on moving forward. I've been in the helping business for 35 years, and without a doubt, this moment is the best moment we've had if you're concerned about alcohol and drug use. This is absolutely the best moment. And I point to 2 things that have happened that I think are really critical. First, the formation of CCOs, and with that, the responsibility of primary care. to take on substance abuse. That is a tremendous policy shift. In my lifetime, up until this moment, almost all of addictions treatment has been conceived of as a kind of, to be crude about it, a sort of third world social service. And moving it into healthcare means that we have to be a first world kind of help. And it also, most importantly, broadens access for people. I like to remind people that the overwhelming majority of people who stop drinking and taking drugs and stop taking tobacco or smoking tobacco do so without any help. They don't access our services. And that doesn't mean their life is easy and it's easy to quit. They just struggle. The consequences are well documented. So we don't have a treatment system that's accessible to a lot of people. So moving it into primary care, and I hope someday into schools more readily, will mean that more people will be identified earlier in their alcohol and drug using careers before they develop alcohol and drug dependence and the kind of struggles that you've had. And so that I'm really thrilled about. There's another thing that Oregon's done that I think is very important, and I encourage you to make sure that it stays this way. You all are familiar with the prioritized health conditions. There are hundreds of health conditions on that list. If I asked you if you knew where substance use was, would you know?
It's below the line.
Last time I looked, it's number 5. That means to me, those two items to me mean that we take substance abuse seriously now. We realize that it's a cross-cutting problem, that it's significant, and that we need to do something about it. In my lifetime, when I think about my grandparents describing how their neighbors detoxified people on their living room couches and practiced a kind of form of folk medicine where they would give somebody a shot an hour the first day, a half a shot an hour the second day, how it's migrated into social services, I think, throughout most of our lifetimes, and now into healthcare, this is great. This is a really, really important moment for us. So I applaud all of you who've helped make that happen. Now for the sort of cautious-y parts. I don't think healthcare is as fully prepared as they need to be to wrestle this big bear to the ground. And here's what I mean. You can't make this up. I do get phone calls like this. Someone will call me and say, gosh, you know, my mom is not doing well. All of a sudden, she's drinking a lot, and we discovered she's taking minor tranquilizers prescribed by her doc, and cognitively, she doesn't seem right. Can you identify a geriatric psychiatrist with a subspecialty in addictions that we could send her to? And isn't that what we would all want? That sounded pretty good. They don't exist. You can't find one. If it was one of your grandkids, your son or daughter, and you said, hey, you know, how about a pediatric psychiatrist with a subspecialty in addictions? Don't exist. Nurses don't get trained in addictions. I teach at the Portland State University School of Social Work. We're just beginning to do some training there. And this is not my way of trying to put a gloomy image on this. I'm thrilled that healthcare has embraced this. But what I do want to interject into our conversation and understanding is this is really a time for patients. Throughout all of my lifetime, we've had a fairly narrow view of how to help people with alcohol and drug problems. Karen reeled off a list of how we have women's treatment, how we have an emerging group of kind of subspecialties. But the plain truth of the matter is we have a lot to learn. And I'll give you a good example. I'm pretty convinced that we need specialized care for women who struggle with addictions. We know that the physical problems they have are different than men. They tend to suffer more organ problems. We know that half of women who struggle with alcohol problems have significant trauma histories. Here's what we don't know. We don't know which women should get that specialized care. And I'll give you another example. We're working now at CODA with Oregon Health Sciences University to help them with a problem that they have on their hospital units. They're trying to help people who have very, very severe infections. They're so severe that they need IV antibiotics. They can't be treated with oral antibiotics. And they're in the hospital for a very, very long time. Well, as luck would have it, people who struggle with alcohol and drug problems, if they're in a hospital, it doesn't mean their hospital stay interrupts their alcohol and drug use. And the hospitals are scared to death. They have people who are literally shooting drugs into their IV lines, and they don't know how to manage that. This is my way of identifying something that I think is really the future for us with healthcare, and the point about being patient. We have to learn how to do that now. We don't have models that are developed to do that. I'm very excited to be a part of those kinds of changes. They're long in coming. But I want to remind you, as you think about some of the questions you were asking about, what to look at, what's the state of our field, what kind of resources are available. I just want to let you know that there are exciting opportunities there in helping people, but the knowledge is in many ways very, very new. You were asking about evidence-based practices. I can tell you, running one of the larger treatment agencies in the state, we do our absolute damnedest to use evidence-based practice. But our workforce is on a kind of migration path from that older way of doing business to this newer one. And it's a real challenge. And it's not just a challenge for me running an agency. It's really a challenge for all of us to understand and appreciate and sort of give time where time ought to be given and patience so that people can develop the right services. But also, I'm all for holding people accountable, too. You want value. Taxpayers want value, too. So to get to my last part, I saw a couple of you looking at the clock a little bit ago. I know it's late in the day. I sure appreciated your point earlier, Senator Mona Sanderson, about follow the money. I would encourage you, as your work moves forward, follow the money. Take a look at what the penetration rates are like in CCOs. And lastly, as far as the money within CCOs, if CCOs are going to embrace substance abuse and mental health problems, they are absolutely going to have to migrate some of the resource from physical health to behavioral health. If we want to provide the access we know is important, if we want to develop the quality we know we need, and if we want to create the savings that we also know we need to continue on this transformative path. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Senator Montesanderson.
I know we're getting late, but one comment, not really an answer, that I've been concerned about is with all these different CCOs, they can contract with anyone. Their panel for drug addictions can be whatever. And I ran into a person that was getting, they were in the health share CCO, and its unit actually, or its the treatment center, the health share contracted with them. She moved here, and the CCO here wouldn't accept that treatment center that she was in, and she was at a loss. But she moved here, and so those are some things that we need to get some more coordination, because once you get somebody into treatment and then they happen to move and this CCO says no, we don't want them, we don't want to contract, sorry, they're not under our panel. I think that's a concern that we need to look at, because that's not in the best interest of the patient, and it's an accessibility issue. And when we get someone that's in, oh man, not being able to follow through, that's just tragic. So I just needed to point that fact out, because if there's one person that told me, there's probably more situations like that out there. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. This was really helpful. So with that, I'm going to close the information hearing on our addiction system and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 428.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 428 updates statutory language concerning alcohol and drug treatment and has an emergency clause, and there is no subsequent referral.
And we have nobody signed up, but it is Senator Cruz's bill. Would you like to enlighten us?
Madam Chair, if I could, there are written testimony has been received, but no one has signed up on that.
Okay.
On both of these bills, there's a little history here. Former Representative Freeman had pre-session filed these, okay? And so when Representative Hurd took over for Representative Freeman, Representative Hurd says, what the heck do I do with this? And I say, give it to me and I'll do it. Okay, then I totally forgot about it. So... but this bill, quite honestly, just kind of does some language modification. Plus, it removes the limitation from the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, so they don't necessarily, because they go after a lot of federal grants and a lot of other sorts of funding, and so this would not mean every time they get a new grant they've got to come to the Legislative Assembly, and because right now there's a spending limitation that is put on them, and so this would just remove that spending limitation. So ain't no more complicated than that.
So it's under, I didn't see the written testimony because it is under the, oops, I just clicked out of it. It's under the meeting date.
Oh, Madam Chair,
under the bill.
Members, all of the testimony received is on Senate Bill 430, my mistake. Senate Bill 428 only has the preliminary staff measure signed.
Okay.
List.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's just kind of technical word changes. You know, I mean, Senator Gelser, you know that Tim was deeply involved in this stuff,
right,
on the subcommittee and all of that. So
okay.
This
okay.
would, okay.
But I really feel someone from the agency would
have some information about it.
Yeah, because.
Has the agency done an analysis on the bill?
No one. Yeah, we need to get away
yeah.
right here.
Is that something we could get you to do sometime?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
so we will bring this one back. Is that? And just a question in general. So when I go to get ready for a hearing, I go to the bill, and then I look in the bill and I look in the pieces. So it doesn't go into the written materials don't go under the bill. They go under the hearing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for example, when we have an informational hearing,
mm-hmm.
it will be under general meeting materials.
Okay.
And the information that's uploaded under a bill number should be in both places. Had there been something submitted
okay.
for Senate Bill 428, it would have appeared under
Got
the
it.
Bill.
As so if well I click on 430, then it's all there under 430.
Okay. And
okay.
Madam Chair, my other excuse, and it's a really weak one, is the fact that I'm on five committees in the transportation work group, so I'm still trying to keep up with the flow.
You can bring us candy, Senator.
Real weak, yeah.
I said it was weak. I didn't say it was
okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 428 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 430. So do you know anything about this bill?
This bill looks relatively straightforward to me. It just allows the Board of Psychologists, Examiners, the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors to deny license for somebody who's been convicted of a sex crime, which I think makes perfect sense to me.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 430 doesn't have a subsequent referral and does make that authority explicit. I believe they have that authority already, but it makes it explicit.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It just
still would like the agency.
Yeah. Is that, could we have the agency, or I guess it would be the Board of
Medical Board.
Yeah.
What's
Board
that?
Of Psych.
Oh, and here you are. Welcome. Thanks for helping us out.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Randy Harnish, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers. And for about 48 hours more, I'm the interim director for the Board of Psychologists, Examiners, and the Board for Counselors and Therapists.
And could you spell your last name
yes.
for us so we can write it down?
H-A-R-N-I-S-C-H.
Thank you.
So when I saw this bill, it was kind of... caught my attention because it directly impacted the three boards that I'm working with. And as has been said earlier, These three boards already do have this language, but it is kind of each statutory authority for the board is slightly different. For example, the psychologist examiners review whether someone has been convicted of a felony or misdemeanor and then may deny, suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew a licensee on that basis. Social workers, the language is convicted in Oregon or another state of a crime that is a felony in Oregon. And again, they can deny, suspend, or revoke, or refuse to renew. And the counselors and therapists language says convicted of a crime in Oregon or other state or federal that brings into question competence. And again, they can be the deny, suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew. So while we do have, the three boards do have language that allows us to already take this action, the language that's suggested in the bill would specify very clearly and consistently across the three boards that the boards have the authority to, again, in this case, it's just to deny current applicants, which is a little confusing, considering we also have the ability to revoke and suspend licenses as well. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to field them.
Senator Cruz, do you have a question?
No, he's absolutely right. It's, you know, it's kind of, there's a theme in this legislative assembly, as you well know, with some of the bills we're doing in Judish on, you know, in fact, you carried one today on the floor, and this kind of fit in that theme, and you know, when I got this from Representative Freeman, I looked at it and said, damn, that makes perfect sense to me, so.
Well, I have a question, though. I mean, there are degrees of sex crimes. I don't know much about what the degrees are. I don't even know. Does this 18-year-old having sex with a 17-year-old, could that 18-year-old could be convicted of a crime? So I'm just wondering how you can divine. I mean, is there stuff in
statute? An 18-year-old and a 17-year-old, no.
There isn't? Yeah, so that wouldn't be considered a sex crime, but legally, possibly it could.
Chair Gelser, Senator Montes-Anderson, the language is discretionary. It allows the boards to take action on the basis of a conviction of any crime that's listed in that that long list of sex crimes. It doesn't require them to. So the boards have the discretion to look into the situation and determine whether it would be appropriate to take an action based on what you describe, or if it's to impose some kind of lesser sanction or.
Well, it's a crime. I guess if someone had a crime like this and then gets their license later, you're saying it wouldn't affect that person then. Right. I just want to have that explained to me.
Senator Gelser, Senator Montes-Anderson, as I understand the bill and the way it's drafted, it says that it would allow the boards to withhold licensure from an applicant who has been convicted of one of the crimes on that long list. It doesn't say that they must withhold a license, but it says that they may.
And it doesn't say that you may revoke. It says you may deny an applicant or withhold from an applicant.
Correct. Current statutory language allows the boards to take that same action. But as I was saying earlier, each board, the language is slightly different. And so what you're looking at would offer a little bit more consistency from board to board. But honestly, it doesn't add a whole lot to what the boards already can do.
So, Cheyenne, would you, for the committee, it references the list of crimes that's in ORS 181.805. Would you be willing to pull those and send them to us on the committee? And that would answer your question, mm-hmm. Senator Montes-Anderson, of what's done. We received some written testimony on this that talked about that it might be useful to post this on the websites for the three organizations. Is that something that would be common practice to get information out to those in the field about pending legislation, not typical practice?
Certainly, the boards, we could post something about this bill on the website. Absolutely.
And that might be a good way for those that are interested to.
Well, I'm just reading. There's criticisms, and I'm just reading the one from Robert Plomadon. Anyway, it'd be nice for the board to look at his criticisms of 430, because since I don't deal with this type of thing, I don't know if his comments are valid or not.
Madam Chair,
Senator Dimbro.
Another piece of written testimony that we received had a criticism of an existing provision in the law that refers to good moral character as being a requirement. And that person was concerned about the vagueness of that, and, you know, it seemed to be hailing back to an earlier time, and that might be something worth cleaning up. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Gelser and Senator Dimbro, you know, obviously we have language that's been on the books in some cases for a long time that uses terms that may have had more meaning at that time than it does now. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, any time you have a term that is, you know, a little bit vaguely worded, it means that two people can look at it and come up with two different definitions, which makes application more difficult.
What about Senator Olson? Is he of good moral character?
Boy,
we could change it and require bad moral character, I suppose. So, last time I checked, good moral character isn't necessarily a negative, I don't think, is it?
Well, there are two pieces of evidence that are listed on OLIS that have concerns about this bill, and when I read them, I don't, you know, I'm not on judiciary, but I really would like to have those concerns dealt with before we would pass this. I would hate to have untoward consequences, because on the surface it seems, you know, no-brainer, but I am concerned about the testimony here.
And I think it's worth pointing out, too, I'm curious about those questions. The third piece of testimony in there is supportive of the bill, and it is from COPACT, the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy, and their key paragraph, two paragraphs, they say, it is essential to the safety of those in Oregon seeking mental health care that all licensed providers are screened to ensure that they have no history of sexual offenses in Oregon or other states. Now that criminal background checks are a required part of the licensure process, there is no extra work added to the licensure boards to seek out additional information about an applicant for a license. COPACT has learned that some persons living in other states who were convicted of sex offenses there have moved to Oregon and have then been able to obtain licenses to provide mental health services only to reoffend here in Oregon with their new clients. So I'm wondering if that might be the genesis of the...
I'm fine with a lot, you know, having been on judice for 10 years, I kind of read it like, you know, I mean, this could very easily have been assigned to the Judiciary Committee because it's dealing with that sort of issue, so...
Usually I take Gail Meyer when I have questions mm-hmm. like this, because she's so knowledgeable and in supporting perpetrators, I should say. I shouldn't say that.
That's relatively
Oregon Defense Attorneys Association.
Oregon Defense Attorneys Association. Thank you. That's better.
Innocent until proven guilty.
Yes.
Are there any other questions or Senator Olson?
Yeah,
do you want to get in comment on this?
Yeah, the last one was they were against it because due to lack of transparency in the presentation of the bill, it wasn't posted on your website. But I mean,
that's
our system works that we post it on ours, and because we're doing the
This wasn't their bill, so why would it be posted on their website?
Well, that was their big concern. There wasn't transparent, but I mean, OLIS is out there for everybody to look at, and
no, I don't think
he obviously found it. So,
all right.
Well, we've all exercised our OLIS now to find testimony. Awesome. Isn't this fun?
Well, OLIS working good, isn't he?
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill? It's your big chance. Nope. Okay. See, does anybody else want to talk about this bill anymore? No? Okay. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 430, and we will seek further information on both of these bills.
Thank you.
Is there anything else we need to say or do, Cheyenne, or are we complete? All right. So we closed the hearing. I guess we're done. We're adjourned.
Time to spare. Time to spare.